This is Leo Baybue for KTWH Two Harbors Community Radio. It is our December special edition of Wandering Nature News, usually accompanied in the studio by Michaela Rice, the naturalist from Gooseberry Falls State Park. Michaela is on board today, but we have a very special guest, and I'm going to turn it over to Michaela Rice to introduce our guest and the topic for today. So
Leo is super lucky. He is talking to two Michaelas at once. So I am introducing our lovely guest from Texas, Kayla Killam. And she works as a wildlife damage management program specialist for Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Service. And I know Michaela from grad school. So we share that resource management in common. And I learned about pigs down there in Texas when I was going to grad school. Got me, you know, kind of in the know. Now we're talking about feral hog management on an agency level. And so I tapped in Michaela to bring us her knowledge. Yeah, we're going to be discussing kind of this hot topic in Minnesota, feral hogs. But before we like wallow into that mud pit, Michaela, would you give us just a brief description of other topics that you commonly discuss with the public in your job or other stakeholders?
Absolutely. So like you said, my area of expertise is wildlife damage management. And what that boils down to is I work in all sorts of different areas where human and wildlife conflict exists. So a lot of my time is spent on feral hogs, but I also do quite a bit of work with predator management, with managing migratory birds that cause issues, whether that's through vulture predation, wading birds at aquaculture facilities, or even just birds that are over and abundant in urban areas. And then we also have beavers. There's a whole variety of areas, as you know, where humans and wildlife can kind of butt heads a little bit. And when we're talking about native wildlife, a lot of that is how to coexist, how to manage the issues. But when we talk about the invasive species, such as feral hogs, a lot of it is how to remove them from the landscape, or if for some reason that's not an option, how to minimize the damage as much as possible.
Sure. So what I kind of heard you say is there's different goals depending on maybe the species or the ecosystem. But would you say that there are some common management strategies that you use that you think we'll be talking about in this little conversation?
Absolutely. Yes. When we talk about, again, for wildlife damage management, a lot of times the approach we take is an integrated wildlife damage management plan. And that's a long, fancy way of saying there is not one tool that's going to solve your problem. We have a lot of tools in the tool belt, and it's going to take a variety, a combination to figure out what works best, and it's going to vary from one property to the next. We have that approach in both categories, but I would say when specifically talking about feral hogs, we actually rename it to integrated pest management. Mm. And the difference there is, I'm sure we're going to talk about in more detail, but you know, pigs are a non-native species, and so we classify them as a pest. Our goal is not coexisting with these animals, it's removing them from the landscape and preventing damage.
Okay, so can you walk us through our, what I learned as a pink farm pig, or our belted pigs? You know, they're what I think of out on the landscape as being in a captive breeding farm facility. How did they become feral hogs? Can you tell us about feral hog origins in the United States?
I can. We can go too far back probably, so I'll try and pick some middle ground here.
Yeah.
There's a lot of names. I really dove into this. I wanted to have background, and so I've got it ready in my pocket. But so there's a lot of names when it comes to pigs, and you're right. There's all sorts of different domesticated breeds. We talked about Eurasian wild boar. We have feral hogs. Since I've been in this position, I have learned all sorts of fun names they go by across the country. We have razorbacks. We have wild pigs. We have river rooters. Like I said, lots of fun names out there. But the important thing to understand is scientifically, they're all the same species. Sus scrofa is their scientific name, which from a management standpoint means there's lots of interbreeding going on. And so when we look at these lineages and where they came from, pigs were introduced into the Americas really, really far back. From what I was able to find, the first documentation was actually during Christopher Columbus's second voyage to North America, where the pigs were intentionally released onto Caribbean islands. And as European exploration continued, these pigs continued to be brought over. Now, in Europe at the time, there was a lot of free-ranging practices going on. And so as explorers coming to a new area where they had zero background, not a lot of survival knowledge for this ecosystem, they did the same thing here. They released the pigs, let them fend for themselves on the landscape, found them, gathered them as needed. As more settlers were in the area, there was a little bit more livestock management, but they were still free-ranging livestock. And the same was going on in Europe. Now, in China, domestication of pigs also happened around the same time. Like I said, we can go like way too far back. But as world trade began to be more common, populations were bigger. Some of the domestication practices we see today, where they're penned livestock, they're fed scraps, very controlled environment, started to be seen more in Europe as well, as they were able to trade with the pigs, with the people in China who already had those highly domesticated animals. Okay. And so what that means for North America is that pigs were introduced at varying levels of domestication over hundreds of years. So we have a real tapestry of genetics on our landscape. Now, again, I'm in Texas, and so when we narrow down on what's going on in Texas, in the early 1900s, and not just in Texas, in a lot of places across the United States, there had been overhunting going on. There was market hunting. There were not game laws in place. And so a lot of our native animals had very dwindling populations. And however, people still had interest in access to hunting, access to wild meat, things like that. And so Eurasian wild boar were brought over. Now, they are the wild counterpart, no domestication efforts whatsoever, were brought over for hunting experiences. And I know y'all haven't been around pigs up in Minnesota as much as we have down here, but it is really hard to keep these animals captive. Mm-hmm. And so through accidental releases, through flooding, through down fences, and of course, sometimes intentional releases, we have a mixture on the landscape from that feral domesticated animal that was put onto our landscape over hundreds of years, now mixed in with the Eurasian wild boar. And if you'll let me go down this rant just a little bit further. So the reason this is important is because when we think about domesticated animals, there's some specific goals we work for as humans, whether it's a cow, even all sorts of our meat-producing animals. We're looking for things that grow quickly, that mature early, that reproduce in large numbers, because we want them to do these things for us so we have access to that resource. So what we have in the landscape today is a combination of an animal that has been hunted and is a challenging animal to hunt for hundreds, thousands of years in Europe, combined with an animal that was designed to reproduce quickly, early, and often. So we have an issue on our hands of our own creation.
Might I interject as a non-wildlife biologist type? I wanted to remind ourselves, Michaela might have been a good, Michaela Rice, it might have been good to start by kind of acquainting folks with why we're talking with Michaela Killam from Texas A&M Extension today. And that's because very recently in the last 8 months or so, there have been newspaper reports about the fact that there are super pigs in quotes, feral hogs in Manitoba that have been reported to be within miles at times of the Minnesota border. And it begged the question of, wow, we have not really had an ongoing discussion of this particular exotic meaning not native, invasive species. And the fact is, Michaela down in Texas, that, yeah, Michaela Rice and I don't see pigs as we go about our day. But in some parts of this state, we're the second largest hog producing state in the country. So it becomes evident that there definitely could be an interaction down the road between our agricultural husbandry of the livestock, the domesticated pig, and these so-called super pigs coming from the north.
Yeah.
And so that's what was the genesis for us calling you today, Michaela. I don't know if that puts any spin on things, because we always thought wild pigs were coming our way. They'd be coming from the south, but now apparently they're coming from north of the border as well.
I'll add a few things to that. We also have, as a state, constantly kind of managed small populations of feral hogs, Leo. So as captive facilities maybe have some outlaws, you know, there are these local, like, let's say, exterminations, right? So we've kind of been battling this for a while, not on a front of a population of wild boar, but locally developing our own like strain of feral hogs. And
Could I ask, do you mean that these were in controlled facilities where they they were in enclosures?
No, like let's say in a county, a farm had some pigs escape, and after a few years, you know, there's a local feral hog population that the DNR goes in and like takes care of.
We have had an ongoing, very low-level issue.
Yep. Okay. As long as,
Something I was aware of. Thank you, Michaela.
Yep. So that's kind of the backdrop where we face feral hogs internally. But then, like Michaela said, they've also been brought out to the landscape so we can hunt them as humans, right? And all those genetics are mixed. These pigs kind of have different roles for us. But once they're in the environment, they wreak the same amount of havoc, which we can get into in a second.
I'm just intrigued because I looked at a distribution map of the U.S., which counties in the U.S. had recognized feral hog populations, and there was no county indicated in Minnesota
so
as having a feral hog population.
The way they count having a feral hog issue is different than like these local kind of breakouts.
Okay.
And that's also a weakness in how we report wildlife data and like nuisance data and ag data. That is something that like the DNR as an agency should consider, how different agencies and populations are getting different information on these pigs, right? There's all these issues, political issues. We could talk about wolf hunters, but you know, what are they going to want with pigs? Let's have Michaela at least tell us while you have this very pensive thought on your face.
Leo. No. I wanted to circle this back to the expert in the discussion.
Yeah.
You and I are speculating about what's going on in Minnesota. Texas has, like, if I remember right, a third or a half of the wild hogs in the country.
It's a high percentage. And like Michaela Rice was saying, you know, that is one area where there's a lack of information because they're not a game animal. And so we have practices in place to keep track of populations of game species that fall under game management like our native species do.
Right. If we really haven't zoomed in on it, could we talk about all the ways in which ecologically and economically and public nuisance and safety-wise that these feral pigs become a problem and all the different avenues of their activity that are problematic? You know, what's the big deal? There's the question.
Can I say it unscientifically first, Michaela, and then you can back me up?
Yeah, go for
it. It's like a trash panda raccoon combined with skunks, dirty, smelly, okay, messy, with bears, big, strong, messy, greedy, hungry, with squirrel, bunny, make lots of babies. I mean, like skunks. Yeah, that's just like what a pig is combined. Okay, take it away.
Yeah, I could see that as a good description. It's really coming at us from a lot of different directions. So I'll start off by saying it is hard to put an economic number on this impact. And when I go through the list of impacts, maybe that'll put that in perspective a little bit. There's lots of estimates out there, but I would say there are a lot of localized estimates. Like, oh, this specific issue in this state for this people has this dollar impact. But when we look at the impacts they're having, they are so across the board, it would be really difficult and probably really scary to put a dollar amount on the damage they're causing. So I typically break it up into four broad categories. So starting with just impacts to natural resources, when we talk about feral hogs, there's two things they need for habitat. They need access to food and access to water. They are a very general animal, and so they make it work in a lot of different locations. But because water is so important to them, a lot of times they concentrate on those areas. And so their rooting behavior, they use their snout to dig into the ground to look for food. A lot of times that's the roots of plants or soft, tender, new growth of plants. And then they love acorns, other nut-producing trees, things like that. So they're digging into the ground, disturbing the soil everywhere they go, in addition to wallowing. I did love that joke in your intro, Michaela.
Thank you. That was excellent.
But so those soil-disturbing factors they're doing across their range, and it has a lot of different impacts, but especially around our waters. If you've taken any watershed management classes or even ecology backgrounds, you were probably aware of how important the plants along a body of water are. They help prevent erosion. They help keep the banks in check. They prevent sedimentation, things like that. And so we have pigs going through and intentionally removing those because that's a great food resource for them. That's easy for them to wallow. And so they are damaging these watersheds, but also they are introducing a lot of bacteria into those watersheds. You know, there are reasons we have regulations about agricultural operations and their runoff and their refuse not going into a watershed. Well, we have large populations of feral pigs that are intentionally going to these watersheds and relieving themselves, to put it nicely. Mm-hmm. And so there is high levels of E. coli being introduced into these waterways to the point where it can even be considered impaired by different regulatory agencies. And so that's just impacts to our waters. I mentioned they're favoring nut-producing trees. We actually did a study out in East Texas. Not we, I say that as in the people of Texas. There was a study in East Texas, and it was an exposure study, which I love because they can just really highlight the impact that this species has. Basically, they fenced off one area, prevented pigs from accessing it, and then monitored another area that the pigs did have access to. And over time, they saw that the foraging, the rooting, the consumption of native plants that was going on in the area pigs had access to was so impactful that it was actually changing the plant community. In that area, they were losing some of the native trees in Texas, that some of our oak trees, they were a lot less frequent, whereas some of the non-native trees were actually surviving. They weren't, their nuts weren't as appetizing to the pigs, and so they were actually thriving. And so in addition to having this pig damaging our surroundings, it's literally changing the plant community surrounding it. And so like I said, it's hard to put a dollar value on these impacts, but you can see they're severe.
So just to summarize a big point she just said, the pigs over probably a much shorter amount of time, because Kaylee didn't mention necessarily duration, but a much shorter amount of time can favor invasive species on a property just by what they eat, the pattern of what they eat and how they disturb the soil. Yeah, the change, the destructiveness to the ground, the earth. We already have major erosion issues up here, so we can't even imagine. Leo had mentioned impacts to agriculture. So would you mind just touching on that and just a little bit about kind of just brief wildlife vectors?
I just want to interject. To reintroduce everyone for the radio audience that's joining us this morning. I have Michaela Rice that many local listeners are familiar with from Gooseberry Falls State Park. And we have another Michaela on the line from us from Texas A&M Extension, Michaela Killam. And I'm sorry, I kind of lost the flow of the question, but do you want to address that agricultural question, Michaela, in Texas?
Yes.
Michaela in Texas.
Yes. So we're covering impacts that feral hogs have, and they're so vast, we're kind of having to go category by category. So I just covered some of the natural resource impacts. I'm going to go ahead and jump to agricultural impacts. And if we split this a little further, we can see agricultural impacts to livestock operations and to our row crop operations.
Right.
So for livestock, in the same way they're competing with our native wildlife, if you have resources on the landscape that you've put there for livestock, if you have free-ranging livestock, pigs see that as a resource and they'll take advantage of it. When we look at the distribution of pigs in Texas, they're statewide, even though they need access to water. And if you think about it, as we have agricultural and livestock operations across the state, that means we are putting water on our landscape. So there are a myriad of photos of these pigs using concrete stock tanks that are made available for cattle out on the landscape. Well, if a pig can access it, that's a resource a pig can use too. Same with food. If you're putting food out onto the landscape, pigs are opportunistic omnivores. There's a lot of things that they can take advantage of. And we even see issues sometimes with predation of young livestock. I said opportunistic omnivore. They will eat animals if the opportunity presents itself. And so we see those issues. Go ahead, Michaela.
No, I was just going to say, you know, animals that are a decent size, like fawns, they're probably, you know, these pigs are huge. They can get up to 300, 400 pounds, depending on their genetics. Theoretically, they could be even bigger in the north than some of the Texas hogs because warmer bodies do better in northern climates. So just think about that.
Yeah, that apparently seems to be one of the things that they were talking about the super pigs coming from Manitoba, is that apparently there's enough domestic wild cross that they're getting larger, and the larger pigs are, you would think, would be that any pig would be susceptible to being on its own in the winter, but they're burrowing under the snow
And, yeah, they're intelligent and even, animals.
Yeah, and they're even bringing cattail fronds into yes, their den yes. to, for insulation.
Domestic kids, pigs, they're kind of like kids. They'll decorate their nest with fresh stuff. So we're even seeing these very complex behaviors like out in the wild that are literally helping them survive all of these climates. They are the perfect invasive species.
when you think about where they're coming from, you know, their native range, the native range of the Eurasian wild boar is across Europe and Russia. And so they are very familiar with cold environments. That isn't where we see the majority of them today. A lot of them are throughout the southeastern United States, but there is no reason genetically why they shouldn't be able to succeed in those colder northern climates as well.
Yeah. I guess this brings up the question then, if they're so well equipped for success, and from a number of things I've read, there's a lot of problematic, there's almost like paradoxes in the efforts to control them, where hunting and trapping and game management, nothing seems to uniformly be predictable for working to, if what you want to do is reduce their numbers from what they are now towards zero. It's a really challenging row to hoe. I mean, do you want to talk about the different values that we bring to the management of wild hogs? Have you, in Texas, reached a happy equilibrium? or?
Well, I tell people all the time, if it was a quick and easy answer, my job would be quick and easy.
So you'd put yourself out of work.
I'd be okay with that. There's other wildlife conflict I can work on. I can definitely talk about some of the tools we have available, but like I said, it's not going to be a one-shot fix everything, or we would have fixed it already.
Right.
So, like I said earlier, when we talk about managing pigs, it's an integrated pest management approach, which means you can't rely on just one tool. As we said, these are smart, these are adaptable animals, and really with any sort of wildlife management, you have to rely on a variety of tools or they will figure out what direction you're coming from and change their own approach. And so the big categories we talk about here are going to be trapping, snaring, using dogs to catch pigs, shooting the pigs, aerial gunning, and toxicants. Those are kind of my six big categories I talk about. And they all have pros and cons. And like I said, you cannot rely on just one. And we talk about, you know, in the Southeast, there's a history of feral hog management because they have been an issue on the landscape for so long. And one issue we saw is that we can't rely just on hunting to remove pigs. We talk about shooting as a tool. Its pros and cons are that in a state where we have lots of hunters, it's typically a cost-effective option. You already have all the supplies you need. You can go out and take care of it. But you're only removing one or two pigs at a time. And so when paired with other tools, it can be a great way to get rid of the last few that are on the landscape. In Texas, you can use additional tools that you can't use on native species, such as suppressors, night vision, thermal vision, things like that are available for managing this animal. But it's not a one-shot solve all, because again, you're only able to take a couple off the landscape at a time. However, trapping can be a really great option because depending on the trap you use, you can catch an entire sounder. And a sounder is what we refer to as the large group of pigs that travel around. A lot of times those are related females that are traveling together to protect their offspring, improve survival. And so if you have a large circular trap, there's a whole variety of traps on the market that you can purchase or build yourself. If you go about trapping correctly, you can catch that entire group at once and minimize the chances of educating any of them or creating trap-shy pigs. Like I said, there's a lot of options here, and it depends on who's managing as well, what resources they have available, what time they have available. When we start to see pigs in urban areas, what regulations are in their area that they can or cannot do. And so there's a lot of limitations that lead towards picking the tools that are going to be right for your specific situation.
I hate to interject when we're going hog wild talking about feral pigs today with Michaela Rice and Michaela Killam, who's joining us from Texas this morning. And thanks so much for joining us, Michaela. But we're running the clock down to where I have to rein in the discussion a bit. We've just kind of touched the surface. Maybe we will like to talk to you again about this, because I don't want to put you on the spot. You're in Texas. We're in northern Minnesota. We're near boreal forest. We have an apex predator known as the timber wolf here. The possibilities are endless almost for what we could discuss. But Michaela Rice, maybe one last exchange between you and Michaela, and we'll adjourn for the morning.
Yeah, it's so complex, but I just wanted to thank you for your time, Michaela. If you have any, I don't know, closing remarks or your favorite pig fact, we would love that. Yeah. I can, just thank you for your expertise and for your time.
Well, thanks for having me. I guess the only closing remark I would say is I'm glad to hear y'all are on top of this. Y'all see the problem on the horizon and you're looking for answers. That gives you a leg up compared to those of us who have had them on the landscape for hundreds of years. I think y'all have a real shot if you take action of getting the species under control and managing the damage in your areas.
Thank you, Michaela, so much. As you can imagine, in a state known as the land of 10,000 lakes, the fact that these wild pigs can be so deleterious to a watershed makes us shudder almost.
Yeah, we love our riparian areas. Don't you dare touch them.
You've got motivation for action.
Indeed we do. I'd just like to thank you so much, Michaela Killam, and hopefully we'll have you back sometime and maybe we'll have some specific questions. Unfortunately, they may come because we'll be having more experience with wild pigs. It looks kind of inevitable. I don't know, Michaela Rice, do you think it is inevitable that we'll be talking about wild pigs in Lake County, Minnesota?
Yeah, maybe in like the next 10 years, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, eventually.
We may have to have a hotline to you then, Michaela Killam, down in Texas.
Happy to help where I can.
Okay. Thanks so much for being with us today in Wandering Nature News, Michaela Killam. Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Bye now.
Bye.
And so, Michaela Rice, that was a very interesting conversation about feral pigs. Any last thoughts on your part or anything the audience needs to know this December about anything phenologically or up at the state park?
Well, there are some other active critters out taking advantage of this kind of mild weather. So I'd love to talk about them next time.
Next time might be in the new year.
Yeah. Still got some other wildlife stories on my mind. Jackie Fallon is coming again at the end of the month, December 30th. Bring your friends if you haven't seen her. She's going to have three birds with her likely. Just a fantastic way to interact with a researcher, someone who knows a lot about raptors in Minnesota. I have a Chasing Waterfalls day hike the day before, Friday the 29th, at Gooseberry Falls State Park. So if you're around, that's just a general slow moving program. We talk about the creation of the falls and why Gooseberry Falls State Park became the best state park in Minnesota.
And if people want to confirm the date and the time of the the Friday or the Saturday event, on the 29th
please or 30th. Go online and check the Parks and Trails event calendar. There's also our secondary Gooseberry Falls Interpretive Social happening on the 29th as well, that Friday. 3 o'clock in the Visitor Center, 3 to 4, come by the fire. I'll be out there. Other staff will be out there as they're able. Other people in the community, come say hi.
Fantastic. Thanks, Michaela. It's been a packed year, and as we draw to the end of it, I wish you the best for the holiday season and the happy solstice. And
goodness, yes.
And we'll see you on the radio.
Sounds great. Love from the lake.
Bye. This is Leo for KTWH Two Harbors Community Radio.